From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Axis of Evil comedy tour makes a stop on our show. Comedians Maz Jobrani, Ahmed Ahmed, and Aaron Kader are Americans, respectively, of Iranian, Egyptian, and Palestinian descent. Ever since 9/11, they've had to deal with a lot of misunderstandings and ethnic profiling. Ahmed Ahmed was arrested at an airport and spent 12 hours in prison. But they've managed to get some very funny material from these difficult times. Their special premiered on Comedy Central last month. It's out on DVD this week. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new memoir by novelist A.M. Holmes about meeting the biological parents who put her up for adoption. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are three members of the Axis of Evil comedy tour. Being of Middle Eastern descent in America after 9/11 and during the War on Terror has given these comics plenty of good and often discomforting material. Maz Jobrani is an Iranian-American. He appeared in a recurring role on 24 and is in the ABC sitcom Knights of Prosperity. Ahmed Ahmed is an Egyptian-American. He'll soon be seen in the film Vince Vaughn's Wild West comedy show. Jobrani and Ahmed were first on our program together in 2002. Aaron Kader is the son of a Palestinian father and a Mormon mother, which he says gave him many reasons to be a comedian. He had a recurring role on The Shield. The Axis of Evil comedy tour special was shown last month on Comedy Central. It's out on DVD this week. Here's an excerpt featuring Ahmed Ahmed.
I'm watching the news, too, and it's like it's kind of messed up because they're showing like all these terrorist groups. Okay, there's like several organizations out there, Islamic Jihad, people think Hezbollah, Hamas, Al-Qaeda. There's so many. How do you know which one is the best one to join? Like, if you choose to join a terrorist organization, how do you know which one is the best one to join? Is it like rushing a fraternity? I think they have recruiters. These guys sitting outside of the mosque going up to these little Muslim boys. Come here, Habibi, come here, come here. I want to talk to you, come here. Don't go to Al-Qaeda, they are shit. Come to the Islamic Brotherhood. Why, you ask? Oh, they only promise you 72 virgin. We'll give you 72 virgin, one whore. And a goat.
Ahmed Ahmed, Maz Jobrani, Aaron Kader, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, naming your group like the Axis of Evil and your shows, the Axis of Evil comedy tour, it kind of like sets people up knowing what they should expect. And I'm wondering, like, if it has given you each more freedom to do this as a group under like the Axis of Evil umbrella.
Well, this is Ahmed here. It was funny because Maz and I were at the comedy store last night and we saw Mitzi Shore. And Mitzi Shore is the owner of the club who initially put us together. And she originally started the show as the Arabian Nights. But because Maz is Iranian, Persians were like, we're not the Arabs, we're Persian. You know, we had our own empire. So we changed the name to, you know, because of that. And also because Arabian Nights was a little too dated. And after tossing it around and seeing what was going on in the world and, you know, how our president was labeling, you know, these countries as the Axis of Evil and how we all sort of played a certain part in that. We thought, what better way to sort of put it on the forefront? You know, the name's provocative.
And say we're evil and then come out smiling.
Yeah, that's the thing we did was take the word, the term Axis of Evil and put the word comedy behind it just mm-hmm. to kind of right off the bat lampoon that term.
But we also, I think also, all of our experiences were similar in that we always talked about being Middle Eastern before 9/11 and noticed that people were not even at all curious. There was a lot of apathy. And after 9/11, there was a lot more curiosity. And it was a way to kind of get people to listen to something that they probably wouldn't have before. And so by grabbing them with a good title, with it, you know, with that, it kind of definitely made us more comfortable. Like, okay, you know what you're getting into. Now we can get into what we want to get into.
And even with Middle Eastern people, you know, we started getting a lot of gigs from Arab cultural centers and Middle Eastern groups and Persian groups because they didn't want to have boring keynote speakers at their events. They wanted comedians.
Do any of you have relatives in the Middle East who really don't get what you're doing, who don't get like the humor and don't have that absurdist take on things that you do as comics?
This is Ahmed here. I get, you know, I'm from Helwan, Egypt, which is a small village outside of Cairo. Not necessarily a village, but it's a small city.
Pretty big town now.
Yeah, now they are. They've grown. And I get emails, believe it or not, from like distant cousins that are like, hey, we saw your website, man. This is great. Good for you. We will be looking out for you. Please come to Egypt and do a show.
Yeah, this is Maz. Iranians have always had a sense of humor, and it's always been, at parties and stuff. The way parties always unwind at an Iranian party is that they sit around towards the end of the evening, and it's almost like a talent show. Someone will sing, someone will tell jokes. Mm-hmm. And so I get all kinds of emails from Iran supporting it. And the only time I've had any difficulty with my stand-up in front of an Iranian crowd is if it's an older Iranian crowd that doesn't speak English that well. And the problem there is they still laugh, but if you have any sort of irony in your jokes or if there's any sort of sarcasm, they're not too good with that, because that's just, I think, an age thing sometimes with the older Iranian crowd. So
younger people might be more cynical and understand irony, but I think in general, Middle Eastern people, they do understand irony, but it's definitely not the first thing they laugh at.
It's more straight, like you know, there's, like, I think a lot of Iranians, like you're saying, like Iranians before what we're doing now, were used to kind of like the jokes that they would tell at parties. It's like, you know, a Polak, a so-and-so, and so-and-so walk into a bar, but like in Iranian terms.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's, yeah, that kind of stuff.
I have tons of family in the Middle East too, but I've found that they've been extremely supportive because it's, you know, at least we're represented, our, you know, people in the media, and they know that that is a necessity for us and something that's good.
Aaron, in your act, you talk about driving with a cousin in the Middle East, mm-hmm. talking about how much they really hate America. And is that a true story, and would you tell it for us?
Yeah, it's, you know, I exaggerated enough to make it, you know, a good bit on stage, but it was a serious situation where we're in Amman, Jordan, and my cousin is, you know, America, you guys, it's so this and that, and you think you're this and that. And then we're passing a Dunkin' Donuts and a KFC, and I cut him off and said, hey, Fayez, you like the Dunkin' Donuts? Yeah, I go there from time to time. I like it. It's not bad. And my dad and I are kind of, you know, winking at each other like this guy hates us and loves us at the same time. And then that whole night after that conversation, I was sitting there thinking, this is hilarious. I got to do this on stage. You know, so it was one of those natural situations that turned into a bit really fast.
How did you change it for stage?
Well, we were talking, I can't get into all the politics that he was talking in that situation. So, you know, I just have him going, you know, right into, you hungry? You want something to eat? We got the Burger King, McDonald's, Pizza Hut, Applebee's. You know, is that a TAIF Fridays? Think Allah is Fridays, no problem, you want? And then, you know, and that stuff didn't happen. But there is that situation or that experience in all my travels to the Middle East. Like, Ahmed probably knows this. On the Nile River in Egypt, there's these boats that have restaurants on them. And they're just parked there. They don't go anywhere. It's just set up for people to eat. And there's a Chili's on the Nile River, you know, and to me that just like blew my mind. So it was kind of a cumulative effect of like all the Americanized products and then their sentiments were totally in contradiction.
Maz, you tell a story on stage about how your email account was closed because of a joke that you told. Is that a true story? And would you tell it for us?
Yeah, I did I do a joke where I say, I have a friend who asked me about, you know, he thinks I'm an expert on the Middle East, so he's always asking me when the next terrorist hit is going down. And so I did that joke one night, and then another friend was in the audience who emailed me the following day jokingly, and he said, hey, I had a great time at the show. By the way, when's the next terrorist hit going down? And then I was actually a little scared to email him back at first because I thought, you know, am I being watched? And then I thought, no, I'm not being watched. I can joke about this stuff. So then I sent the email back, joking back with him. And then the next day I tried to log on to my email account and it said account closed, access denied. And then I tried to contact this company and I couldn't get through to them because they didn't have a phone number. So I had to email them and explain who I was. And I said, I'm a comedian. You know, I don't know why I got shut down. And then I contacted this organization called NIAC, which is the National Iranian American Council, which is like the NAACP of Iranians. and I started talking to them, and basically there was two theories going on. One was that it could have been that they said that I'd sent spam, and that's why they were closing me down. I hadn't sent spam. I'd sent an email recently, around that same time, just talking about our shows and stuff. But at the same time, my contacts at NIAC were saying that they do have certain programs that recognize certain red flag words, like anything having to do with terrorism or anything having to do with, let's say, child pornography or something. And these programs will shut down your account because they don't want it to come out that you were doing something illegal through their services. So, yeah, I got shut down, and then I finally got back on, so I'm back on.
I wonder, if I had sent the same joke, whether they would have closed down my account.
Yeah.
I don't know. They might be watching you, Terry Gross.
My guests are three of the four members of the Axis of Evil comedy tour, Maz Jobrani, Ahmed Ahmed, and Aaron Kader. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are three of the four members of the Axis of Evil comedy tour, Maz Jobrani, Ahmed Ahmed, and Aaron Kader. They are Americans, respectively, of Iranian, Egyptian, and Palestinian descent. Their Comedy Central special comes out on DVD this week. Have any of the jokes that you've made had consequences? People have misinterpreted it, or authorities have misinterpreted it?
Here in the States or overseas?
Either.
I had a little bit of a tiny controversy. I was in Dubai. I went there three times last year, and the third time I was there, I did a show. And they have in Dubai what they call the CIDs, which is the sort of secret police that drive around as civilians. So you never know if you're standing next to one. And they got tipped off that there was this comedy show at the Radisson Hotel. And they came down, and they came at the very tail end of the show, and I was, in fact, doing my show, and then I did a sort of screen projection of Aaron and Maz's acts. So it was sort of like a presentation, if you will, to try to do some business with the comedy and sell the rights and so forth and so on. And they came at the end of the show, and they didn't know what was going on. Where's the permit? What kind of material is this guy doing? Who approved it? That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And our producer... my producer at the time sort of pulled him aside. He told me, hey, go stand over there because these guys want to arrest you. And he sort of talked him out of it. And then they said, well, we're going to come back tomorrow night and watch his act. So there was some of the producers said, hey, you don't do these certain jokes.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely jokes that get misinterpreted.
Wait. So did you have to cut jokes out?
Yeah. So he said, don't do certain jokes. They wanted to arrest you. You know, I'm just telling you, he works, you know, in the entertainment industry over in Dubai, and he's from Dubai, and he understands the politics and the law and all that stuff. It's very strict when it comes to stuff like that. And he basically just said, look, don't do this joke, you know, edit that piece on that joke. You know, we sort of went back and reconstructed my act. Well, the next night I went up on stage and did my set, and sure enough, the secret police were sitting in the audience, and they were in stitches. They were laughing so hard.
What did you take out because you were afraid you'd be arrested?
There's a joke I do. It's not even a joke. They're more observations, really. If you've ever been to Dubai, it's a very decadent, you know. I don't know if you saw it in the DVD at all, but there's the bit that I do where I say it's, you know, they have the only 7-star hotel in the whole wide world in Dubai. And when critics asked who gave it 7 stars, the emir was like, I give it 7 stars. It is my hotel. I'll do what I want to do.
Me.
And the producer, my producer friend was like, don't say that, because then you're like making fun of the emir. And I was like, well, no, I'm not. It's like, you know, it's more of like an observation. There was another one. Dubai, if you go to, you know, when you go to Dubai, it's a Muslim city. And it's, you know, technically a very strict Muslim city, but it's so liberal and it's growing and progressing so fast. But it's sort of schizophrenic in a sense, because you'll go down to the beach, you'll see Muslim women wearing hijab, you know, over their head, like scars around their head, and then you'll see like European men in Speedos, you know, like side by side, which is just kind of bizarre. It's a bizarre visual to see a hijab woman and like an overweight guy in Speedos do their G-string. And then you'll see like a mosque, and then right across the street from the mosque, there's a nightclub like attached to the hotel. So around 8 o'clock every night, you know, you'll hear the Adhan call the prayer. Allahu Akbar, Allah. You start hearing the techno beats and it's confusing. And people think, oh, you're making fun of it. I'm not making fun of it. That's what you see when you go there. Mm-hmm. So I had to, you know, for the, you know, sensitivity of people's, you know, the way they would react, I had to cut some of that stuff out.
I think, Terry, that...
That's like all your Dubai material, isn't it? I mean, like the whole, it's like the whole chapter came out.
You know, the same thing happened in London. I was, you know, privileged enough to get invited to do this show amongst a bunch of other performers at the Royal Albert Hall in London in front of 3,200 conservative Muslims. And the organizer did the same thing. He pulled me aside. I had to sit down with the sheikh or like an imam. And they edited my act for me, and I had to sign a. I swear to God, and they were like redlining jokes. You can't say that. You can't say that.
What did they redline?
The one joke where I say whenever I go through an airport, whenever I go through airport security now, I just put on a G-string. I just show up. They say you can't say G-string
you
here.
Cannot do this.
So I was like, really? They're like, no. Just say, you know, you
undergarments.
Yeah. I mean, it was very delicate, and they actually made me sign a contract. So if I breached whatever I said I wouldn't do, then they wouldn't pay me.
Ahmed always has a line that makes me laugh, even though it's not intended. But he has CDs that, you know, he'll sell at shows, and there's one that's kind of uncensored, and then there's the other one that's clean, you know, no cussing. It's for children and Muslims.
And you know what's so funny is after my shows. People will come up to me and say, is that really for children and Muslims? Because I have three kids that don't want to hear your uncensored one. So I'll take three CDs.
So, like, when you're in the position of having, like, a sheikh edit your material or, like, the secret police basically editing the material, do you feel like I'm going to rebel against this and stand up for free speech? Or do you feel like I really want to perform in this country and I'll do what
Not
it
at
takes?
All.
Yeah.
No, I do what it takes. I'm a rare breed, Terry, because most comics would say, forget that. You know, I'm better than that. I'm an artist. I'll say what I want to say. You know, and that's all fine and dandy. But then you end up sort of excluding yourself from, you know, the universal message versus, you know, some people like to have their niche core that they talk to. And I think I come from more of a place where, okay, you know, I'm a comedian. My job isn't that serious. I can bend a little bit. Mm-hmm. I'll cut out the G-string bit. I'll cut out the bit about the whatever. It's like, I don't mind.
It still has to be about the audience.
I don't mind bending, you know, not my spirit or like, you know, my vision or my material, but it's more about compromising a little bit. You got to give people a lifeline.
You can't
just say this is my way or the highway. I think there's a
in America you can though.
Yeah.
No, but I'm saying there's a sense of as a comedian there's a sense of, you know,
Please the crowd that's in front of you.
Yeah, we're entertainers. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense of give and take that's involved. And I don't mind, you know, giving a little bit to take a little bit.
There's also the question of who's trying to edit you. Is it a comedy club owner or is it the secret police?
Right? Exactly. I mean, no, exactly. And there's a big difference. And also, is it being edited because it's offending somebody's religious sensibilities or it's offending the person who holds the power in the country and is suppressing his people?
Both, really. Both, mm-hmm. Because a lot of it's coming from, you know, a sort of selfish point of view and a personal point of view. And the other is for the quote-unquote cause. But, you know, in Islam, you know, everybody's cause is different. There's 72 branches of Islam. There's so many different way people practice it and believe it and observe it. So the way I observe it might be different from the way a sheikh observes it in Dubai.
Now, are there any things that you find it uncomfortable to joke about, even in the United States, where there aren't secret police who are editing your material?
Cancer and rape. Mm. I don't think are funny.
Yeah, you still don't talk about rape, cancer, AIDS, Holocaust. Those are not good comedy.
I've just started to do a joke, not about the Holocaust, but about the president of Iran, saying that it never happened. And so it's also how you your take on it.
Mm-hmm. What is it?
Well, the joke I'm doing is I say, you know, I'm talking about the image that Iranians have in America isn't that good. And I say the president of Iran isn't helping any because he says stupid stuff. And I say, like, he came out and he said the Holocaust never happened. And I say, that's just so stupid. Why would you say that? And I go, even if he's dumb enough to actually believe that, doesn't he have a friend that he can run it by before he tells the rest of the world and embarrasses every Iranian in the world? Mm-hmm. Doesn't he have some friend where he could be like, hey, Hassan, I'm thinking of telling the world the Holocaust never happened. What do you think? I don't know, Mahmoud. Maybe you should keep that to yourself. You know, you should maybe try saying something a little less harmful at first. Go out and say Holocaust, Schmolocaust. Try that. See how that goes. And then work your way up into a political diatribe.
Yeah.
But that's making fun of the guy saying it never happened, right?
Yeah, getting into the mentality of how that happened.
Absolutely, absolutely. Getting back to what we were talking about, if there are subjects that even in the United States you feel it's difficult to joke about, are there subjects related to the Middle East or to how Arab Americans or Iranian or Palestinian Americans are treated in America or terrorism that you feel like, this is really funny, but yet I cannot go there?
Aaron, mm-hmm. You probably have stuff about the Arab-Israeli stuff.
I do, and I've always found that people are either completely unaware of the situation or they're vaguely aware, and so it's this kind of challenge of getting them to understand it without understanding it. Like, they don't have to have any knowledge of it to kind of get my jokes, so it's kind of almost like watered down in a way. So then it comes off not as edgy, but then after 9/11, there was I did take a couple of cracks at jokes that didn't end up making it, like, you know, the Al-Qaeda camp, you know, I didn't want to go to Al-Qaeda camp. My mom dropped me off. I don't want to go. But then when she comes to pick me up at the end of the summer, I don't want to leave. I love this. You know, we play capture and burn the flag and kick the oil can. And
capture and burn.
That's a great bit. You got to keep doing it.
I know. And it's like one of those bits that I did too soon after 9/11. And then I just bailed on it because people were like, I don't know if we can joke about that. You know, it was too
definitely a lot of that.
And then recently I was doing this joke that I was really surprised got a laugh, where I said, hey, we all know Osama's evil, but gosh, he's a good camper. What is he, an Eagle Scout? God, you know, like, where did he get this tent with a kidney dialysis machine? Which, you know, sporting goods store is he going to? Like, what has he got, an eye tent from Seattle? What is it, you know, you got a webcam that beams your video straight to Al Jazeera? Like, where does he? And I kind of go on about this and talk about how, if you know, if you leave Bush in a mountain range, we'll find him or he'll die. You know, like, there's not going to be, how long is he going to survive with a flint and a machete?
Ahmed Ahmed, Mazdebrani, and Aaron Kader will be back in the second half of the show. The Axis of Evil comedy tour comes out on DVD this week. It also features Dean Obadala. They're on tour together now. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ahmed Ahmed tells us what it's like to have the same name as one of the terrorists on the FBI's most wanted list, as we continue our conversation with three members of the Axis of Evil comedy tour. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new memoir by novelist A.M. Holmes. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with three of the members of the Axis of Evil comedy tour. Maz Jobrani, Ahmed Ahmed, and Aaron Kader are Americans, respectively, of Iranian, Egyptian, and Palestinian descent. They're on tour now, and their Comedy Central special, which premiered last month, comes out on DVD this week. Here's a clip featuring Aaron Kader.
Yeah, I got a cousin named Jihad. Any Jihads here? It's a very popular name in the late 70s. I got a cousin named Jihad. He takes the bus now, everywhere. Can't fly. He called me from a Greyhound station, seriously. And he calls me and he's like, this sucks, they're frisking me and ID me and looking at me funny. Screw this, man, I'm changing my name to Raymond. That's good, now your name's Raymond. Abdul Majid. That doesn't change anything. Thank you.
Now, Ahmed Ahmed and Maz Jobrani, I can imagine that you have been profiled because of your names. But Aaron Kader, you're Palestinian-American, and from your name, Aaron Kader, nobody would know that you were from the Middle East. There's a great story behind how you got your name. Would you tell it?
Well, my name is Harun, but there's not a lot of Haruns in the Middle East. There's a lot of Musas, Moses, and Aaron and Moses were brothers, biblically, right? And so it's funny because, you know, my grandpa was Musa. So because Aaron is Moses' brother, my name became Aaron Moses. So in Arabic, it's Harun Abu Musa Abu Khader. But they just changed it to Aaron Kader. And my mom's, you know, white from Utah. And they just, I don't know, I guess they just liked the name Aaron because it was related to Moses and it was my grandpa's name. But then they only gave it one A. And sometimes people ask, and I think the real reason is because my parents were like, well, it's not a traditional Jewish name and we're Palestinian, so let's just drop an A. And I'm like, why don't you just say that Elvis spelled it with one A? You know, like, it's not a good story to tell, like, well, we don't want it to be too Jewish. But the truth is, it's they didn't want us, my dad didn't want us to have ethnic names that profiled us at all, because he grew up immigrant style and feeling like a minority and feeling left out, and he didn't want his kids to have that experience.
No, Ahmed Ahmed, you say that your name is the same name as a wanted terrorist from the Middle East. Is that true?
It's the worst. This is not even a joke. People think it's like, hey, you're telling a great joke. No, if you actually Google my name, don't Google Ahmed Ahmed comedian, just Google Ahmed Ahmed. My website comes up first, and right under that there's a link for the FBI's Most Wanted.
Our researcher and producer Sam is nodding his head in affirmation across in the
right
control room.
Now ask Sam to click on the photo of this cat. He's from Egypt. He's shorter than me, but if I grew a mustache, we'd look alike. And he has like 30 aliases, and one of them's Ahmed Ahmed, and the other one's Ahmed the Egyptian. So like I'm like, I gotta find this guy, man, because he's killing me.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm wondering if he's in the Middle East Googling me going, hey, man, there is this comedian in America, bro, using my name. This is crap, man. I can't believe this.
Have you ever been mistaken for him and been like prevented from going on a flight or whatever?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We haven't talked in a while, have we? I spent 12 hours in Clark County Prison the day before.
Whoa.
Bush was reelected. Yeah. The weekend before Bush was reelected. They had arrested, detained, and or profiled over 10,000 Arabs and Middle Eastern and Muslims around America. And ACLU actually did a sort of count on that statistic. And they contacted me and stuff. But the day before, it was November 1st, I guess, I was flying out of Las Vegas airport, going to do a show in St. Louis with my comedy colleague, Rabbi Bob Alper. We do a show called One Arab, One Jew, One Stage. And I'd gone through security, got my ticket, went up to the boarding gate. People were sort of boarding. The jetway was still connected. And I go up and I give the guy my ticket. And he looks at me and, you know, there must have been some sort of weird, scary alert going on, because there wasn't any questions asked. He just kind of said, hold on a second, sir. You're not going to be able to make your flight. And I was like, oh, well, I have to get on this flight. You know, what seems to be the problem? He said, you're not going to make your flight. He didn't even explain it to me. So we started sort of going back and forth, and then the Las Vegas Metro pulled up, and it was a black cop and a white cop. The white cop just handcuffed me and didn't even read me my rights or anything. The black cop leaned into me and said, "Now you know what it's like to be a black man in the 60s.
Gee.
Like half joking, but half serious. So then they're walking me through the airport really slowly, kind of showcasing me as if to say, "Hey, we got one." And then they took me to Clark County Prison, took my blood, fingerprints. I got new headshots. And they actually made me sit down, Terry. They made me sit down with a jail psychologist who asked me all these questions like, "Why do you think you're in here? Do you think it has something to do with your inner self?"
Like, really?
Like just really weird stuff. Then they put me in this holding cell with pretty much the cast members from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And about 12 hours go by. I finally get on the phone in our cell because people were taking turns using the phone. I get on the phone. I call my buddy. I'm like, "You got to get me out of here. I think they think I'm a terrorist. And because my name's Ahmed Ahmed, and da da da, you know, call somebody and get me out of here." I hang up the phone. I turn around. And this gangbanger, like, you know, clearly, like, you know, isn't a gang. This guy, kid walks up to me and he goes, "Hey, Holmes, so they arrested you because you're Arabic?" And I said, I think so, yeah. He says, "So they think you're like a terrorist?" I said, "Yeah, I'm not, but yeah, I think they think that." He goes, "Well, then blow this place up and get us out of here, Holmes." The whole cell started laughing. And I thought it was so bizarre because I never told anybody I was a comedian. And so now the laugh was on me, and then I started laughing. So it was kind of cathartic and healing. Like, you know, it was sort of like, you know, a way to sort of ease the tension of being in, you know, in prison. But at the same time, I thought it was God's way of saying, "Hey, Ahmed, write some more material, man.
Here's a joke for you."
Well, you know,
guy has an Arabic accent.
I'm wondering, like, when you say to the police who have arrested you, or to the prison psychologist who's interviewing you, and the other authorities, when you try to explain, "No, I'm not Ahmed Ahmed the terrorist. I'm Ahmed Ahmed the comic, and I'm with the Axis of Evil comedy tour."
Yeah.
Like, first of all, do they believe you? And second of all, if they figure out what you're doing, is that helpful, or does that get you even more trouble if the words Axis of Evil come up?
Well, no, here's what happened is I don't even think, were we doing Axis of Evil?
We hadn't, so we started the Arabian Nights.
We were still the Arabian Nights, uh-huh. But I always bring like newspaper clippings or
right.
The interview I did with you or something.
Yeah, he's got
some sort of proof.
Thing.
Yeah, I have proof. So when I got to the prison, to the jail, the deputies or whatever, the sheriffs were looking through my bag and they pulled out all this like comedy paraphernalia, CDs and clippings and what have you. And they were like snickering amongst themselves. "Hey, this guy's a comedian. Now the joke's on him."
It's a good thing you're not a prop comic, like with machetes and stuff, because then they'd be going through it and be like, "What's with the machetes?" Yeah. I swear I juggle. I swear. Yeah.
So,
but there's no rhyme. I mean, you can't sue the government. I mean, I spoke to like at least a dozen lawyers that were like, "You definitely have a case, but it's going to cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars to try to pursue this thing." So, you know, I mean, there's been a lot of stuff that's happened. I've been detained several times coming over the Canadian border, doing shows, being pulled over and detained in New York quite a bit. I mean, I know all the people now, the TSA. We're buddies. We have pizza together. We call each other. We text message each other. "Hey, I'm coming down." You know.
Aaron and I always joke that Ahmed's the best guy to travel with because they'll always pull him over, and then we could just sneak our contraband cologne over.
We need a diversion.
Terry, also too, with all the stress that's been happening with me, I started getting alopecia areata, where your hair falls out from stress.
He's been demuslifying,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
but demuslimifying.
Demuslifying myself.
No,
my body's
no.
Trying to demuslify.
No, you are balding. Is that a joke? Is that
no,
just a
no.
joke? Is that true?
No.
That's why you lost your hair?
I was traveling so much that every time I went through an airport, I mean, I can't tell you, I was like Tom Hanks in Terminal. I was living in airports for about 2 years, doing shows by myself, with the guys, separately with other comedians, whatever. But, you know, because we have to travel and go through airport, it was a really, like, you know, excruciating experience for, you know, the couple years I was doing it, because I was always getting stopped, always missing flights, always and it was a very stressful time in my life. So my body started to shake off some of that Chewbacca hair that I have.
Wow. It sounds like you've really been through a lot in order to travel around the world being funny.
You know,
paid your dues for us.
I've taken the bullet, I guess.
Yeah. My guests are three members of the Axis of Evil comedy tour, Maz Jobrani, Ahmed Ahmed, and Aaron Kader. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are three members of the Axis of Evil comedy tour, Maz Jobrani, Ahmed Ahmed, and Aaron Kader. They're Americans, respectively, of Iranian, Egyptian, and Palestinian descent. Their Comedy Central special comes out on DVD this week. Here's an excerpt featuring Maz Jobrani.
I'm the Iranian. And it's funny because people, I tell them, my American friends, I go, yeah, I'm Iranian. They go, oh, so you're Arab. And I'm like, no, we're actually different. We're not Arab. But, you know, I mean, we're similar. You know, we're all getting shot at. You know, that's one thing. But, you know, but Iranians are actually, ethnically, we're actually, you know, we're Aryan. We're white. We're white. So stop shooting. You know, that's what I'm trying to... And then my American friends go, well, how can we tell you apart? How can we? And I go, well, it's in the accent. It's in the accent. Iranians, when Iranians speak, they talk a lot slower. Iranians talk like this. Iranians talk like this. We talk very slow, like, you know, maybe we just shot some heroin. We are falling asleep. How are you? How are you? I am Iranian. How are you? How are you? It's Iranian. Okie dokie, it's Iranian. Take it easy, don't worry about it. I'm Iranian. And Arab talk a lot faster. Arab talk faster, Arab talk a lot faster. Arab talk like they're just some cocaine, they're talking. How are you? How are you? How are you? How are you? Ahlan masalan, ahlan masalan. How are you? Ahlan masalan.
No, earlier we were talking about subjects that are difficult to be funny about, and Maz Jobrani, you're kind of like in the middle of one of those situations now because you're Iranian American, and conflict is really escalating between the United States and Iran. So, how are you dealing with that, if at all, as a comic and as a person?
Terry, actually, it's interesting because I think about that on a daily basis because I have family there, and obviously, you know, I was born in Iran, and I love that country, and I love the people of that country, and I also am American, and I love this country, I love the people of this country, and so every day, I hope for a peaceful solution. And one thing, a reporter once asked me, you know, what are the similarities and differences between the lead up to the war with Iraq and now what this might be a lead up to a war with Iran. And I said, unfortunately, the similarities are too much. There's too many similarities. And I said, the one difference would be if they actually gave diplomacy a shot. And it's very frustrating and it's hard to make it funny because you're right, I do get very passionate about it and I want to talk about the serious issues and bring it to the attention of the audience. I find myself now more taking a few seconds or maybe, you know, a minute to get into some sort of a positive message, some sort of a serious message in the middle of my act. And then once in a while I'll hear the silence for too long and I go, ooh, I haven't told a joke. So then I'll just, I'll kind of change gears and then sprinkle a joke in there to go back to where I had to go. But I try now to consciously put a message out there that Iranians are good people, that most Iranians are, you know, very good, very productive people, and I put that out there as much as I can. I just wish that there was some sort of peaceful resolution so the people of that country don't end up having the same tragedy happen to their country that is happening in Iraq.
Yeah, I almost want to say this, Terry, is that, you know, as a comedian, it's almost like we're taking a poll every night just in the room,
mm-hmm.
and you kind of take the temperature of where... Mm-hmm. You know, where we're at as a culture, and after you do enough shows in enough different cities, you start to get the vibe of what everybody's kind of feeling. And I think in general, we take the politics seriously. We like to read the paper, and we kind of get addicted to it, and we have our opinions. But it's so hard to know where they're going to be cynical and where they're not, because in general, people are very cynical about the Middle East. They don't believe that the people are capable of having a democracy, or that they're the, and it's there's a lot of cynicism out there. And as a comedians, we're definitely cynical, but it's difficult to have a cynical take and to make fun of it and then have people, like just regular Americans, react to it with apathy and cynicism at the same time. It's a really weird kind of situation that we're in because people really have no idea what to think. There's no clear answer out. It's just, you know, it's a very convoluted time.
Let me get back to the subject of what you all do professionally, acting and comedy. Now that you're all getting better known as comics, is it affecting your acting career? Or are you getting more opportunities beyond the terrorist roles?
It just sort of, we just kind of got on the map recently as our Axis of Evil tour. So it's, you know, I mean, I've definitely...
Inshallah.
God willing. I definitely get a lot of, you know, emails and people and industry response. Hey, we saw you in this. You're great in that. But as far as roles are concerned, you know, I'm trying to develop and pitch ideas that are more mainstream for Middle Eastern Americans and Muslim Americans as far as being cast in things. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm still being considered and cast for stuff that's not outside of the box, you know, that's sort of stereotypical parts. But, you know, you take those parts for exposure and to get a paycheck. And if I don't take them, they're going to give it to a Mexican guy.
Right. Terry, this is Maz. I made a conscious...
Thank you for that late laughter.
Terry, I made a conscious decision not to take any terrorist parts and also anything that's negative in a way. You know, there was an audition for a movie that came up where it's kind of like a Crash type film, and they have all these families, and the Iranian family is living in America, and there's these two brothers. One's a lawyer, one works for like the INS and whatever, ICE now. And they, the lawyer who is Americanized, brother, he commits an act of an honor killing where he kills his younger sister who was sleeping with a Mexican guy. And I didn't go out for that because I said, first of all, I don't know if this has ever happened in America where an Iranian family has committed an act of an honor killing. But I said, even if you can point out to this incident happening in America, I said, we have so much negativity out there. This negative image out there, such a negative image out there that I don't support that. You know, we don't need anything else, even a little drop where someone could go and subconsciously watch a movie and leave the movie going, see those Iranians, they're crazy. You know, did you see what they did? And so I've made a conscious decision not to take those parts. Mm-hmm. That said, I do, you know, I played a cab driver on that show, Knights of Prosperity, an Indian cab driver, which I don't mind doing that, which is that's a stereotype, but it was a comedic stereotype, and also it's a character. I know those people, like I know Indian cab drivers, and also the character was written with more depth.
Also, I going back to what you were talking about earlier, getting opportunities and stuff. There was an opportunity that I got speaking in regards to Vince Vaughn, who you interviewed. Mm-hmm. We did a comedy tour that he produced and hosted, called Vince Vaughn's Wild West Comedy Show, 30 Cities and 30 Nights. And we went from Hollywood to the heartland, all through Middle America and the South. This was right after Wedding Crashers came out. And he hosted this comedy show with me and three other comedians in front of like 2,000 people every night. There was rarely, if not, you know, any Arabs or Muslims in the audience every night. So it was funny, like, to see people, to get laughs from just Middle America. But they shot it as a movie, as a documentary film. It's going to be released hopefully this year. But it really shows, you know, that a Middle Eastern person can... Funny's funny, basically, is what I'm trying to say.
Like, yeah.
I want to thank you all for talking with us, and I wish you all really good luck. Thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Ahmed Ahmed, Maz Jobrani, and Aaron Kader of the Axis of Evil Comedy Tour. Their Comedy Central special comes out on DVD this week. The next stops on their tour include Boston, Detroit, Fort Lauderdale, and Atlanta. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews A.M. Holmes's new memoir about meeting the birth mother who gave her up for adoption. This is Fresh Air. In novels and short story collections, such as This Book Will Save Your Life, Music for Torching, and The Safety of Objects, A.M. Holmes has earned a reputation as an unsentimental writer known for her emotional precision. Now she turns that steeliness on her own life story. Holmes was given up for adoption before she was born, and in her new memoir, The Mistress's Daughter, she describes the sometimes traumatic experience of being found by her birth mother. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
The scene is the lunch counter at our neighborhood organic supermarket, where my 8-year-old daughter and her friend, both adopted, are chatting about whom they feel closer to, their mother or their father. I'm eating my sandwich a few stools down, being cool, letting them have their space, and listening like a bat. The girls cast their votes for their currently favorite parent, and then my daughter, with the worldly wisdom of the slightly older kid, tells her friend, "I guess if you're not adopted, you always feel closer to your mother, because you come out of her belly." Her friend nods. That's when I rush in, idiotically trying to de-romanticize biology and score a goal for my team. I tell the girls that that's not true, that a lot of biological children feel closer to their fathers. The girls' attention wanders back to their mac and cheese. I've fumbled. Too bad the organic supermarket doesn't serve gin and tonics. I could use one. The myth of seamlessness, of perfect connection with the mother. You don't have to be adopted to yearn for it, but if you are adopted, you surely yearn for it with a special intensity. The writer A.M. Holmes did. Even after meeting her biological mother and being severely disappointed, she still sort of yearns. As anyone who's read her fiction might expect, Holmes's new memoir, The Mistress's Daughter, is an unflinching, smart, and intensely compelling book. It's about Holmes's particular search for origins as an adoptee, but it's also about something larger, dare I say universal? It's about the mystery of identity and the comedy of errors we all embark on when we attempt to locate our true selves. Will biology take us there? Genealogical research? Therapy? Religion? Holmes's odyssey begins when she's 31, staying at her parents' house, her adoptive parents' house, for the Christmas holidays. Her adoptive mother, in tears, breaks the news. Holmes's birth mother is looking for her and has sent a message through the lawyer that helped handle her adoption, saying that she would be willing to hear from her daughter. Holmes drives herself nuts trying to deconstruct the restrained language of that message. She grew up knowing that she was the product of an affair between a young woman and an older married man with children. She also came to realize that to be adopted is to be adapted, to be amputated and sewn back together again. Whether or not you regain full function, there will always be scar tissue. Holmes peels off some of those scabs when she begins corresponding with, and then talking to, her birth mother over the telephone. Holmes postpones meeting her birth mother. She's too flooded with emotion, too shaky. And her birth mother stalks her, even surprising Holmes at a bookstore where she's giving a reading. When they finally formally meet, Holmes, who grew up in a lefty household of educators and activists, finds that her birth mother reminds her of Dusty Springfield. She's arrayed in rabbit fur and small talk, her hair piled up in a post-beehive bun. Holmes's birth mother is needy, even scary, but she's also poignantly childlike. In one of their phone conversations, she asks Holmes if one day they might have a portrait painted of the two of us. That dream of mother-daughter seamlessness again. Though they're less charged, Holmes's meetings with her birth father are also surreal. He comes off like a minor member of the Rat Pack, swaggering and chipper and talking incredibly about his penis at their first meeting. He makes Holmes take a DNA test to prove their relationship and then says he's going to introduce Holmes to his family, her half-brothers and sister, but he never makes good on the promise, keeping her existence a shameful secret. She outs him in this memoir, sparing nobody's feelings here, including, of course, her own. The Mistress's Daughter can sometimes be a hard book to read, especially hard if you're an adoptive parent. But the ending is a kick. After the deaths of both her birth mother and her adoptive maternal grandmother, Holmes said she felt impelled to have a birth child of her own. The daughter she eventually gives birth to ends up reminding Holmes of her beloved grandmother, to whom, of course, she was not connected genetically. It makes no sense. It makes complete sense. In The Mistress's Daughter, Holmes unsentimentally attests to the undeniable power of blood and to the random miracles of affinity.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A.M. Holmes' memoir, The Mistress's Daughter. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And from Delacorte Press, publisher of The Year of Fog, a novel that explores the family drama that unfolds when a child disappears, by Michelle Richmond. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how new smart drugs are changing cancer treatment. We talk with Dr. David G. Nathan, President Emeritus of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and author of The Cancer Treatment Revolution. And Mohsen Hamid talks about his new novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.